Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another exciting episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is entitled Sex, Lies, and Crime, an interview with sex crimes expert and best-selling author, Linda Fairstein. So now, here's your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Thank you, John, and I want to welcome everybody to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. We have a very special guest this evening. Linda Fairstein doesn't really need an introduction, but I'm going to introduce her anyway. We're going to talk about sex tonight, but not the good kind. Linda is an honors graduate of Vassar College and the University of Virginia School of Law. She's been a prosecutor and one of the foremost legal experts on crimes of violence against women and children. And for many decades, she served in the New York County District Attorney Office, and where she was chief of the Sex Crimes Prosecution Unit. She held that post for 25 years. She's also an international best-selling author who writes a series of crime novels which features a Manhattan prosecutor, go figure, named Alexandra Cooper. And she also wrote a wonderful book of nonfiction that's not for the faint of heart called Sexual Violence, Our War Against Rape. And it was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Linda, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Doug and Jan. I'm very delighted and honored.
We're honored to have you here. So let's jump right into it. Why don't you tell us about your time as a sex crime prosecutor? What were your major duties?
Sure. It was a very different point in time. I got out of law school in 1972, and there were no special victims units anywhere in the country. The LAPD, actually, was the first to form one in a police department, followed by New York. And so the Manhattan prosecutor in 1974 set up the pioneering unit. I was a young lawyer and was asked to take it over in 1976, and it was just the beginning of these issues. I mean, we struggled to get witnesses to come to us because the history of these prosecutions in this country had been so bad, and we worked very hard to change laws to make them better. And if you'd ever told me it could be the work of fiction or a primetime television show, I would have bet every nickel I had against you.
Well, it did both. What attracted you to this work in the first place? I mean, as a lawyer, and there was this need, obviously, to have this unit. What attracted you to get involved in this, and how did this actually come about? I mean, what was the selling points? How did you convince people, or did they convince you that this was something that was absolutely necessary?
Well, you just hit it in that last part of the question, Doug. I was really resistant to do it. The unit was new, and the law had been so bad that in the year before I joined the office, more than 1,000 men were arrested in New York City for sexual assault of different kinds. Only 18 of them were convicted. So I did not want to do this work, and literally the times, as your listeners will know today, are very different. There were women, in fact, in Manhattan were not allowed to try criminal cases in the early 1970s. The DA was so such a gentleman that he thought it was inappropriate work. And so there were 200 lawyers in the office, and I was the seventh woman on the staff. When the unit was formed, the new DA, Bob Morgenthau, in 76, really felt it was critical that a woman be the figurehead in charge of this unit. He thought that would make it more welcoming for victims and survivors of sexual assault to trust a system that had been so unfriendly for decades. And so he asked me to do it. The long part of the story is, if you will recall, that it was the time of the movie The Godfather. So that line, "This is an offer you can't refuse," was very popular. And the DA made the offer to me, and I foolishly said no. I got about 10 feet away, and his number two guy, chief assistant, who's a federal judge now, stopped me and said, "You know, this is not a yes or no question. This is not an offer you can refuse. So you turn around and go back in." And I said to the DA, "I was mistaken. I guess I want to do this." And he said to me, "Look, you do it for 2 years. We'll try and groom somebody else, and then you can do whatever you want in the office, homicides, you know, rackets, organized crime, whatever you want." And we used to pass each other 12, 15 years later in the hallway, and he said, you're ready to go?" And it was the work that was so compelling. I think perhaps because I had it from such an early point in time, and so much change occurred. And we'll get to the science of it and how DNA revolutionized the work. But that wasn't until I'd been in that unit for more than a decade that DNA even became possible. So I was sort of dragged, long answer, kicking and screaming, to do this work. And it's just what I fell in love with in the office.
So you've talked about how the, you know, actually you had this great DA with some foresight there, and how things are working inside the prosecutor's office. But how about your relationship with law enforcement agencies? Because I'm imagining there needed to be some changes in thinking there, too.
Oh, Jan, you're so right. Two things I think that were really interesting. I mean, we fought then for a long time, and these are fights still going on all over the country, to change law enforcement attitudes about these crimes. I mean, they're very difficult to investigate. Victims are often met, especially in acquaintance rape, with disbelief. What were you doing there? How were you dressed? I mean, we heard those questions. I heard them 40 years ago, and many people still hear them today. So we're constantly educating and fighting that battle. The second piece of it is just my own relationship with law enforcement. And I say again, the NYPD, well, there were only 7 women in the office when I got there. The NYPD was more than 20,000 officers at the time, but women had only newly been allowed to be in uniform patrolling on the streets. They were a very small part of the department, unlike today, and they were often called matrons. They were really assigned to stay with children who'd been taken out of homes for abuse. They were they dealt with women who'd been either victimized or arrested, but they weren't allowed to be on patrol. And so I thought, gee, the cops are just going to hate having a young woman in the DA's office working with them, sometimes telling them in legal terms what to do. This needs a lineup. This needs a search warrant. I'd like you to reinterview this witness. And the opposite, it couldn't have been more untrue. And for me, the best memories, and I try and use this in my fiction, is how great the cops were. They were so happy to be met by young lawyers. They didn't care the gender. If you appreciated their work and had an interest in it and wanted to make the cases stick, wanted to do it better and get into a courtroom and get your witnesses through it and triumph. And my harder relationships often were with the senior guys in the office who just weren't used to having women in that workplace, and with many of the judges, all male at the time, who just had no idea of how to deal with young women in the workplace. So from the earliest times, and again, I think I show it in my novels, is how great it was to be accepted by the cops and the forensic scientists and the people really doing the work to make the cases.
So what types of cases did you most often become involved with in that unit?
One of my goals, I mean, it's interesting, in the Manhattan DA's office, going back to the 1940s, a very unique system of working cases was developed with the cooperation of the NYPD. And that is that when homicide happened in the 40s, the police would immediately call the DA's office. There was always a homicide prosecutor on call 24 hours a day, and we call it riding with the police. I mean, the prosecutor would go out often to the crime scene, to the morgue, to the hospital, help direct the investigation, not tell the police what to do, but, as I just said, sort of hopefully the bad example in most places in the country is the cops do their work, they make an arrest, brush their hands, turn it over to the prosecutor who takes it to the courtroom. We always wanted a partnership. We knew we could make this better for the police if we could be involved and say, you know, you don't have probable cause to make this arrest. Do this and you'll get a better case. So that was my model when I got there 30 years later in the 70s. And I asked the prosecutor in charge, Bob Morgenthau, to ask the police commissioner, can we work sex crimes cases the same way? Can we go out in the field? Can we do it so when there's a call, and none of us knew what we were doing. I mean, it was a new area, not that the crimes were new, but it was a new area of prosecution. The laws were changing. And so we'd go out with the cop. They'd call and say, what do we do? How do we ask this guy? It was before, and both of you know this, of course, from Crime and Science, your own work, but it was before there were rape evidence collection kits, and we're going to probably talk about them later, but you know how important they are in this work today. They didn't exist then. So just the issue of getting something that might have been evidence in a hospital exam to a police lab was radical in the 1970s. It was just almost impossible to do. So really my goal as the very young bureau chief was to analogize these cases to homicides and say, let's do it that way. Let's make this an NYPD-DA partnership because the cases will be better. And that was really what we did in every sexual assault. Later, a decade later, was sort of when we gave the same treatment to domestic violence, which was terribly under-treated in the 60s and 70s. Child abuse, which nobody knew anything about, and later on, things like stalking and trafficking. But we developed this partnership. It's one of my favorite legacies to have left behind in the office. It's still done very much like that today.
That's great.
It's put this in perspective. I mean, how big is this problem? Let's say back in the day when you walked into this, when this was in its infancy, how big was the problem? How many cases did you guys run into the first couple of years, and how does that translate into where we are now? Has this problem grown? Has it stayed the same? What's the scope of this problem?
Great question, Doug, and a hard one to answer, because in those days, in the 70s, there were so few resources for victims, survivors of sexual violence. As you both know, there were very few counseling organizations. There were no hospital rape crisis intervention programs. It was the infancy of using forensic science in these crimes, where you have the most intimate kind of contact that two human beings can have. As you know, you can shoot somebody, you know, across the street and not have any forensic evidence really on the victim's body, and these crimes can't happen without. So it was a period of time where in the 70s where survivors were blamed for the victimization. It's the only crime that really people said, what was she doing there? How was she dressed? Why was she out so late? And so it was very underreported. And although sex crimes are still underreported to this day, that's changed radically. And so most people who do this work, like me, have a hard time distinguishing between what the rise in numbers of occurrence is as opposed to the fact that there's so much more reporting. So breaking it down between stranger rape, cases where the victim and assailant don't know each other at all, where DNA is so critical, for example, and acquaintance rape, where people know the offender. They may not know his complete name or where he lives, but they have either dated him or go to college with him or work in the same place that he does or have met him at the same restaurant, bar, over and over. Stranger rape now, unlike then, gets reported almost, I don't know, 99%. It's the services for those victims are really good. People believe them. DNA forensics is just critical. The hospital exam, if there's evidence to be found, crime labs everywhere can develop it and make the connection or an exoneration, just as important. So those cases, there's a much greater rise in reporting, and that's good, and the system works well for those victims. Acquaintance and date rape, still most places believe, most jurisdictions think it's underreported, and I suppose people think there's more of the occurrence than there was 40 years ago, but not in great numbers. I mean, it's much more an issue of, I think, underreporting and getting witnesses to the right place and seeing that agencies do something about it.
Well, you know, I guess that makes sense on a level. I mean, it's one thing to point a finger at a stranger. It's another thing to point a finger at someone you've dated or a classmate or someone in your neighborhood. I mean, the ramifications and ripple effect there personally for the victim is much higher stakes, obviously.
Much higher stakes. It's so complicated. You know, it's there are often people she'll tell the people closest to her, and they'll know both parties, and they'll say, you can't report him.
Yeah.
He has no criminal
history.
You'll
destroy the family.
He'll destroy the family. You'll destroy his career. He's an athlete. He's a pre-med student. He's a whatever. So complicated in so many different ways than stranger rape.
Yeah. Well, one of these cases was the Robert Chambers Preppy murder case, and
yes,
you were involved in that. What was your involvement in that?
So in 1986, August of 1986, a young woman named Jennifer Levin was 18. She just graduated from high school, going off to college a week later. Robert Chambers, who was given by the media this name, the preppy murderer,
right,
he was a good-looking kid from a nice family. He was not a preppy. He was actually a drug-addicted. He'd been fighting addiction since he was 14, in and out of a number of rehabs, college dropout. And he and Jennifer were in the same group of friends. They were all out together one night. The next morning at 6:20, her body was found in Central Park right behind the Great Metropolitan Museum of Art. Body was found by a biker, and police were called. And when the police tried to retrace Jennifer's steps the night before, the last thing they expected was that her killer was someone she knew and had dated. They actually assumed that her body had been, that she'd been killed and thrown, dumped in the park from a speeding car. And instead, when the friends began to say, well, there were 20 of us at the bar, then there were 10, then there were 4, she left with Robert Chambers, went to Robert Chambers' house, and he had deep scratches on his face. There had been quite a struggle to the end of her life. And so Robert Chambers was charged with her murder, and I was the prosecutor assigned to the case a month after that.
Tough one.
Very tough. It was tough on so many levels. It was really one of the first cases of its kind that became a front page New York Times story in our city. That's the great. Serious media outlet, and we have tabloids, New York Post and the Daily News, and they write about murder all the time, but it's not front page fare for the New York Times. But they began to cover all of the issues related to the case, which included underage drinking and sexual trysts of private school kids and money and influence. And so it was a very bizarre experience because it was a rather straightforward intimate partner violence case if you looked at it that way, if you took it out of the spotlight that it was put in New York, and in some measure because of Robert Chambers' then good looks and his perception that he was a prep school kid from the upper middle class. And so it really became a media circus, and instead of being tried a few months and resolved, it took more than 18 months to get the case through hearings and trial and to get to a manslaughter conviction that was actually a plea that was made after 9 days of deliberations, the longest single defendant jury deliberations in New York State at the time, which was really saddening to me because I think without the media, it would have been a pretty straightforward case.
Mm-hmm. Well, things have changed in terms of our awareness, certainly. I'm not sure how many people are aware, though, that now that we have gone on to DNA and other ways to prosecute cases than when you were first starting out. I think a lot of people believe that since the advent of the sexual assault kit that, sort of problem solved. But sort of recently, I think more of us have become aware that tens of thousands of these kits have gone untested. And sometimes because the lab doesn't have the resources it needs to keep up with the increasing number of them, but sometimes they're not even getting to the lab. So I know you're active in this cause. So can you tell us more about this situation of backlog and ignored sexual assault kits?
I would love to talk about it, Jan, and I love the chance also to bring in just the strange way that that media, in this case primetime television, has really helped move this effort. So by the late 70s, and then throughout the 80s and 90s, evidence collection kits were developed and placed in hospitals. They became really essential from 1986 on, which was the first time prosecutors like me were introduced to DNA as a technology. It was accepted in courts in America in 1989. So it suddenly became possible from 1989 on to have a victim who was examined in the hospital who may or may not have had a clear chance to see her attacker, maybe attacked in the dark from behind, maybe burglarized in her home. And so the DNA that was selected at the hospital and then was sent to lab for analysis was absolutely critical. In those days, there was no such thing as DNA data banking, and I assume many of your listeners today are familiar with things like data banks from crime fiction and television, hopefully not from their own experience. And data banks finally made it possible in 1999 to take a DNA sample, put it into a computer, and a match could be generated if the suspect's DNA was actually in the computer system from a crime sample taken after conviction or another crime scene. And before then, from 86 to 99, when we were using DNA, you had to know, you had to have an idea of who the suspect was. A computer couldn't do it for you. So you'd have to say, or the cops would say, okay, we think John Doe is a suspect in this case, and we'll laboriously have the lab try and match our sample to John Doe. And maybe they'd do 4, 5, 6 John Does. It was hugely expensive at the time in the infancy of DNA. So things changed. And when the data banking became possible, I'll give you our example in New York because I think that was really critically essential in moving this effort forward. The mayor of New York at the time was Rudy Giuliani, and he called the group of us who were prosecuting and said, how many evidence collection kits are there in New York that have never been examined? Because we had no known suspect to compare them to. The tally was 16,000 evidence collection kits on shelves collecting dust in New York City that nothing was ever going to be done for, going back easily 10 years. So Giuliani committed New York City money, and it was a lot, found three private labs because the great lab that we have in New York, the Medical Examiner's Office, was unable to keep current with homicide, sex crimes, other violent crimes, and do backlog or cases. So these were outsourced at city expense to three of the wonderful labs around the country. And results began to come back, and they would match cases 4, 6, 10 years old. The police had this remarkable opportunity, it gives me chills to even think about the early cases at the time, of knocking on doors of victims who had assumed nobody remembered that they'd been attacked. Why would anybody care at this point in time? And actually matching the evidence in these kits to known offenders and taking these cases to trial. It allowed us to change the statute of limitation in most states to do this. It's just thrilling work. It goes on today. The sort of shocking thing that has been discovered in the last 5 years, is, as Jan points out, is that around the country, the estimates now are that there are 250,000 kits, at least, that either never made it to a police lab. It just sit untested in police evidence lockers. And it's stunned everybody. Now, the leap to, and I'm sort of smiling as I say this in a radio interview. I'm sitting at home smiling, but the link to this is that, as you know, as your listeners know, there's a 15-year hugely successful show on television called Law & Order, SVU. The star of it, who plays Detective Olivia Benson, is Mariska Hargitay. Mariska, a great actress, but just the biggest-hearted human being I know, decided to form a foundation a few years ago. And what was happening to her was that she began to get mail, first, second year of the show, with people all over the country, not all of them kids, but people began to write to her as the character, believing she knew how to handle these cases and how to help their problems. And she became so involved in this issue that her foundation, the Joyful Heart Foundation, is an advocacy group for survivors of violent crime. And about,
you know, I want to talk so much more about this, but I hear our break music coming up. So let's take a quick break and let's come back and talk more about the foundation.
Great. Thank you.
And welcome back, everybody, after the break. Here's another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Again, today's show is entitled Sex, Lies, and Crime, an interview with sex crimes expert and best-selling author Linda Fairstein. So now back to your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everyone, and I'm glad that we're going to continue talking with Linda, who I have to say I know from personal experience as someone who really gives of herself to good causes and is a very generous person, and so you've really generously been giving a lot of your time to this cause. Tell us more about it.
Well, thanks, Jan, and thanks to you for many years of friendship and good reads. So Mariska Hargitay started this foundation, Joyful Heart, and it does victim advocacy, but Mariska had the idea to do something to end this backlog problem. So first do a tally that really arose out of the Human Rights Watch report on this issue and the fact that all over this country, big cities, small towns, these kits were collecting dust. And so with private foundation money that Mariska's raised through Joyful Heart, the first city that we went into is Detroit, which, as you know, is bankrupt. There's a terrific prosecutor, Kim Worthy, who identified this problem and said there were hundreds of unsolved kits in a city where the crime rate for rape and homicide is through the roof. So Joyful Heart focused on Detroit. It's been a public-private partnership, and so far there are more than, I believe, between 500 and 800 kits that have been paid for, sent out for analysis, and there have been dozens and dozens of hits on the return. They're solving decades-old cases. I think they have 19 serial rape cases solved, and serial rape, so multiple ones in each case, and more than 20 states in which the offenders have been involved. They're now going into Memphis, Tennessee, to do the same kind of work, really welcomed by local prosecutors and police, because this is a godsend. And as you said earlier, Jen, I mean, the fact that not only every woman but everybody in this country doesn't see what the benefit of this is, of solving these cases. These are rarely crimes that an individual commits once and stops. The tendency seems to be that if someone's successful at a modus operandi, at an MO, it becomes a serial case, many of them escalating to homicides. And so it's not only a crime solution problem, entirely scientific, entirely based on the forensic uses of DNA and other trace evidence, but also prevention, because if you can stop these guys, you're preventing just violent crimes, not only in your jurisdiction, but all over the country. One of the first cases I wrote about just several years ago, I mean, not in prosecuting, but 4 or 5 years ago when this project started, was a young woman from California, south of L.A., who was raped, abducted from a gas station where she was filling her car at night, abducted at knife point, and taken on a drive, and was raped by an unknown offender. It was, her kit was never tested. Years later, when Mauritius Group began to agitate for this testing, it was matched to a rape in Ohio, an abduction of the very same kind from a convenience store. And as it turned out, the offender, who was spending the rest of his life in jail, was a long-distance truck driver. So he was going from Ohio all through the western states and then down the coast to Southern California. And so my dream is to retrace his route and get all those towns and cities, test their kits, and see how many crimes he committed. It's just, it's a staggering problem in this country that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt. It makes you crazy sometimes.
Yes, yes.
And speaking of which, Jan will tell you, when she and I get together, we talk about some pretty dark stuff, and as you would imagine. And as a crime writer and a crime reader, I mean, I like dark noir, but there's two things that I don't read about and I won't write about, and that's child abuse and animal abuse. To write about it, you got to live in that world. I won't live in that world. But the other, and it really just makes my blood pressure go through the roof, is sex trafficking. It just drives me insane. It's one of these where you want to take a Louisville Slugger and go into these places and start beating people in the head, because it's just, these are very young people that are taken from homes and off the streets. It's crazy. Now, you've worked on a lot of these cases. Tell us about it. Tell us about what this is all about. How does this work? We think it's Thailand. It's not. It's here, and it's huge.
Wow, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I first want to back up, Doug, and say I'm entirely in your world. I've been in some very dark places since I got out of law school as a naive kid in 1972, a long time ago. I handled child abuse cases. They were run by my unit. I can neither write nor read about it. I will not do a child in jeopardy thing in my books. And animals, I feel exactly the same way. It's just never been a place I wanted to go. Trafficking, as you say, really, it's an age-old crime. And most of the time when we read about it in our newspapers, it's the issue of Thailand. It became the former Soviet republics that were broken up, and the very poorest of them, a lot of the Eastern Europeans were shipped to the East Coast of America. And people think of it as a problem with foreigners who are brought here, some for agricultural labor if they're young men, and sex trafficking, of course, for the women. And many people just don't – I encounter people at cocktail parties in New York all the time who just refuse to believe that it's true, that people are being held against their will in parts of this city, in nice suburban areas. And yet I think the hardest thing to convince people about is that this is a problem of our own kids in this country. And I think we certainly in New York see a disproportionate amount of it, and you in L.A., when I say you see it, you don't see it so much on the streets, but we used to I have cases in my earliest days where Port Authority, which is the big bus terminal in New York, I mean, every kid from the Midwest, from Texas, was, you know, on a bus to come to New York, and there were just predators waiting at the station to meet those kids, promise them clothes, bling, whatever it was, and then put them in a hotel room where they wouldn't see daylight, motel room, I mean, horrible places, wouldn't see daylight for months, if not years. And, of course, rings, I mean, very formal rings, where kids are not coming on the bus and not being brought that way, but are being trucked or trafficked in groups to be used by criminals for these purposes. So the laws, our laws, are changing both state and federal sort of within the last 5 to 7 years. These cases were almost impossible to prosecute. And now we have prosecutors like the New York County District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., who's just made this a primary goal of his to bring this issue into the light and make people understand it. It's still so little understood, and the numbers of it, the numbers of these cases, the number of young people being trafficked for the purpose of sex crimes is just one of the most vile things I've encountered in the system.
Yep, I understand it. Like you said, a lot of it did. They think it was, you know, the Eastern Bloc countries that the breakup of the Soviet Union kind of took the lead in all this. But aren't there other countries that are now coming in and involved in this? I mean, nationals from other places.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think if you talk to, especially the advocacy groups, because as you might guess, some of these cases never make it to the courtroom. Many of the victims won't stay around. I mean, they'll be liberated, but they just want a safe place to be. But we're seeing it from a lot of places in the Eastern Bloc, as we have been, a lot of parts of Asia and the Asian islands, Africa, Latin America, a lot of Mexicans being brought to New York, a lot of Central Americans being brought here. So it's a problem everywhere. And the victims of it are being brought to the larger cities, I'm sure many other places, but we see so much of it in New York and Atlanta and Miami and L.A. Shocking.
Yep.
Hmm. Yeah, and so basically also you're dealing with victims that have been so abused psychologically on top of the physical abuse that I'm sure just getting the cases together from there must be difficult.
Yes, I mean, that's always, Jan, a problem with sex crimes and special victims cases, adult victims, child victims, the emotional abuse, and when the crimes have been prolonged, when it's not a single event, but somebody who's been held for weeks or months, or an incest case that's gone on for a long time. These cases, you for example, I had an Eastern Bloc case where, this is 11 years ago before I left the office, where the victims were teenage girls, and it's the promise of a better life and the promise of going to America as Europeans have always come to America, that it's going to be a better place. And they hide in the trunks of cars to get over a border, to get to the Black Sea, to get onto a freighter. And all of these promises are made. They get here, and they're captives. They're slaves.
Sure.
And they don't get out. And so, as you said, I mean, some are held for a few months. Some are held for more than a year. So who do you trust? You get out of this, and why do you want to stay here, and where's the government going to put you that you can be safe? And How do you go about trusting that you're going to testify against somebody, face him in a courtroom, and think that he'll actually go to jail when you haven't even learned to speak this language, despite that you've been here, despite the fact you've been here 2 years, because you've been held in a basement in a home in Queens? So it's we as lawyers in the system, we as prosecutors, can try to deal with the legal aspects of it. But I think what you've said, what you've just asked, the psychological damage is often of such long pernicious nature that it's great to get these guys off the street and to prosecute them, but I don't have the optimism that I have for many victims I've worked with, where I think, okay, we'll get them in the courtroom, they'll see the justice, there's some kind of justice, we triumph, and we help them get on with their lives. These cases can just be dismal.
I would imagine. So, you know, it almost, the parallel to me is almost like the guys like, you know, John McCain and people like that, they were in the Hanoi Hilton. Okay, so you're under total control of these people who obviously do not have your best interest at heart. And so, okay, you spend all your time to figure out, how do I get out of here? Okay, now what are you going to do?
Right.
You're a stranger in a strange land. You have no resources. You don't know the language. You don't understand the culture. You don't know who to turn to. You don't know who's good, bad, and indifferent. It literally, you know, you're on the other side of the planet. You're so far away from any safety valve. That's what makes me insane about this stuff.
Yes, yes. I mean, you see these girls who are, as I say, escaping from a situation where they have no future, they have no jobs, the family has no money, they think they're going to do something, come over here, get a job working on in a cornfield in New Jersey or a tomato farm, and send money back home. And they're slaves for 2 years, and their family doesn't know what's become of them. They think they've just stopped writing and calling and, you know, gone off to a better life. And so they're left with nothing, and the despair is just heartbreaking.
Did you find that many of these ended up in homicides at the end of the day?
I mean,
did they just get rid of them when they're finished?
Many. I mean, next to impossible is to measure because,
right,
of course, they're not documented coming in. These are freighters often that kind of come, you know, let people off illegally 20 feet from shore off the coast of Long Island, and they're meant to swim in or come in. So we don't even know the numbers through which some of these young people are trafficked from Latin America, trucks across the border. It's impossible to know. I like to think, mainly because I'm an optimist, I guess, that more get out and are not homicides. But you just asked a question that I simply can't answer. I mean, there are an untold number of young people who've never survived this.
Yeah, but it's not rare.
Not rare. Not rare.
Yeah.
So at some point in all of this, you decided to turn to the pen. I know lawyers do a lot of writing anyway, but fiction writing. So can you talk to us about transitioning to that?
Sure. The funny thing for me, Jim, was that all of my adolescence, all I ever wanted to do was write. And it was short stories. They were always mysteries when I was, in elementary school as an older kid and junior high school, and I had a wonderfully loving, supportive father, and that people would come for, you know, Thanksgiving or birthdays or whatever and say, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I always said, I want to write. And my father used to roll his eyes and say, you have nothing to write about. Get a job, get a career. And I went to college. I went to a great women's college in those days that had an English lit department, and I went to learn to write. And the end of my middle of my senior year, I realized maybe my father was right and that I needed something to do to support myself. My interest was very much public service at the time. I went to law school and never thinking of a prosecutorial career, because as we started this show by saying today, that I never that women just weren't allowed in the courtroom in most jurisdictions. So it was very serendipitous for me that I went into the law at a time when doors began to open, and I found this passion that was a piece of the law, special victims work, that was really changing. But I never abandoned the dream to write. So in the very generous introduction, Doug, the nonfiction book was first, and I was asked to do that, and that was published in 93. And because it was about real cases and real people, I had to go to the city ethics board and get permission to write a book, because I was using as examples and cases people who'd been prosecuted for sex crimes and had their case been appealed. And at the end of my hearing, when the judicial officer said, yes, you can do this, just you can't do it on city time, and you have to vet all the cases to make sure that the results are final, I turned around and I said, how about fiction? What if I wanted, my dream has always been to write novels. And the guy waved his hand at me and said, everybody thinks they can write a book. You know, no problem. You know, do that on your own time. Every cop, every fireman, you get that all the time. Just, you know, go ahead, do it. So I finished the nonfiction book, and that was published in 93. And in 94, it was sort of the dream I always wanted. I thought I would try to write a crime novel, and that became Final Jeopardy, the first one in my series. So it was... It was the writer in me before the lawyer, as opposed to many, you know, and I think by that time John Grisham and Scott Turow had written, and I was well aware of their success as lawyers who transitioned to writing. For me, it was going back and pulling out from that inner core the dream that I'd always had to write books.
Well, your protagonist is Alexandra Koop. And as I said, lo and behold, she's a prosecutor. How did you create her, and how much of you is in her, and how much of her is not, you know, is her own
good
self?
Question. Thank you. Well, you know, it's that old adage that all your listeners have heard, write what you know. So here I was sitting in this office, and from my earliest days in the 70s, people would knock on the door, and the DA would let us talk to them, and they were screenwriters and novelists and writing crime stories and how is it done. And when the Presumed Innocent movie was made, Alan Pakula, the great director, called me and said, can the actress meet with you and shadow you and see what it's like to be a prosecutor? So we'd given away all this great information over the years. And so I thought, well, this is what I know, and other people seem to be interested, so this is what I want to write. It was easy for me to want to also explain this very dark world and why I was interested in it. I think throughout my 30 years in the office, the question I most often heard was, you know, how can you do this work? It's dark. It's unpleasant. For me, the work was being able to give to the victims some kind of justice and see them triumph in a courtroom. The statistics with which we started this show were so bad before I got there that the timing was for me, you know, serendipity, but a really good thing. So I created the protagonist who did the same work that I do. I very much wanted to show through her eyes why I had developed such a passion for it, what was interesting about it. The people who would never go into a bookstore and buy a nonfiction book called Sexual Violence, Our War Against Rape, you know, we'll read our books, I say to you and Doug, you know, we'll read our books. And so they're meant to entertain, of course, because they're crime novels, but they're also meant to educate. And so in each of the books, there's some aspect of one of the issues. You know, I've done trafficking in a book, and I've done, you know, all kinds of sexual assault, serial killings. I've done domestic violence. So it's really putting both of the passions together. And it was very easy for me to sort of look into my own work and pull out characters from that.
Well, I think that's one of the great things about our genre is it does actually look at a lot of these elements of our society that maybe others don't. Tell us about your latest book real quickly. What's coming out
thank you.
Now?
Always a nice question. Coming out in June is Terminal City. It's the 16th novel in the series, and it refers to Grand Central Terminal. I always do, as you may know, New York City history. And so
yes.
The terminal's 100 years old, and it's just one of the most intriguing places in New York, and was originally built with a city underground. Yeah, you can connect to hotels, get off your train, and never have to come up on the street. So there's tunnel dwellers underneath, and all kinds of characters, and bad things happen in and under the terminal, of course.
Trouble ensues.
Trouble ensues. So,
well, I also have to point out that there's a new anthology coming out from international thriller writers
yeah.
called Face Off, which is a wonderful, wonderful collection of short stories where Steve Barry came up with the idea of taking 22 best-selling authors and pairing them up so they could put their iconic protagonist either working together or against each other in a short story. And Linda is involved in that, and she's written a story, a wonderful story with Steve Martini, and that will be debuted at Thriller Fest in New York in July, so sign up and come. Linda,
yeah,
I want to thank
Linda
you.
Will be there.
Yes.
I want to thank you so, so much for being there. She's teaching a class there actually called The Day Job, Fact or Fiction.
I want to go to your
great.
Class, Doug.
So
thank
you
again.
So much for being here.
Great
it was
to
a
talk
wonderful
to you both,
show.
And with so much admiration for you both, I really thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners. Great, great idea for a show.
Well, that'll wrap it up this episode, and like always, we'll have links to for further study and to Linda's books and her website and her blog and all that will be up on our crimeandscienceradio.com blog page. So until next time, Jan and I'll say goodbye to you, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.